We have taken and eaten. I know and can remember hands and staring up, diverse sorts of red, months of herrings.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Kevin Semmes, percussionist, Scott Wostlager, composer, and Abby Miner about their percussion monodrama, We Have Taken and Eaten.
I have the names in the country language fastened with a string.
The truth is that all along the sea, one is ripe in the space.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program celebrating the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with percussionist Kevin Semmes, composer Scott Wostlager, and we'll hear from poet Abby Miner. Their experimental monodrama grew from questions and ideas raised from three sources: the origin stories in biblical Genesis, the journals of John Smith, and Englishman Thomas Harriot's narrative of the first English plantation in Virginia, a 16th century account written in support of North American colonization. This experimental performance piece tries to explore the relationships among relentlessness, productivity, punishment, and oppression.
Cranes, swans, sea crabs.
Percussionists, composers who present an argument on nonlinear meditation,
rare and wonderful experiments,
and origin stories.
I know, I can't remember.
Welcome to Arts and Letters.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You guys are trying for a sense of landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scott, tell us a little bit about composing this piece.
Sure. So I think the landscape was sort of a post-apocalyptic, the world has ended situation. And the idea was, what kind of music would we create after everything was over? That's why we have the tape players and the temple bowls. Things in the light bulb. So it's almost kind of like junk one would find after the apocalypse happened. So that was a landscape that he's navigating.
You say that you think of music as one impression of intimate emotional traces left by these master narratives, and this would be the Bible and then the Virginia narrative.
The truth is that all along the sea, one is ripe in the space.
Yeah, I think that was Abby's thoughts about how these old texts that we think of maybe as just being past and gone are actually very much with us today.
You know, I was originally looking for John Smith's journals, and I had just gone to the section in the library where I knew they were because of call numbers, and then I found this text and I started looking at it. The truth is that into the air and into the water, all along the sea, pounded again, bread or spoon, one is ripe in the space. Since then, I found out that this text is considered the first piece of North American nature writing, which is really interesting to me because what it seems most to be to me is an advertisement. It's a push for the newfound land. It's kind of by turns hilarious and terrifying.
I know and can remember.
Thomas Harriot really starts the book by saying, you might have heard of this new land, and you might have heard some bad things about it from these other guys who have been there. It's nests of chests, bedsteads, tables, desks, colors which we know with fires underneath, sweet flour being used, drying in the sun. But, you know, here's why you shouldn't listen to those guys, and here's why it's really a great place, and why don't I just get right on to the what he calls the merchantable commodities. All along the sea, cranes, swans, I know and can remember, sea crabs, herns. So it's kind of an index of here's all the stuff that we can use in this new place. And it's on the one hand a really beautiful encyclopedia of what he saw and what was here. And then at the same time it's really sort of terrifying because it really is a catalog of relentless productivity.
But we can not much trouble them.
Is it 8 movements?
I guess you call movements or scenes.
Scenes.
Yeah. The way it's set up is it alternates between this "We Have Taken and Eaten" reprise. And that's sort of the chorus character. So Kevin alternates between two characters.
We have taken and eaten.
Something.
One is a nihilistic, mad character who's been traumatized after the collapse of the world. And then this other character who tries to find hope or beauty in these objects that are just almost household objects, where his voice is blending with the sound of the objects.
Their bounds are so wild.
And We Have Taken and Eaten is the title of the piece, but also that's the nihilistic or the negative scenes are titled that.
And can remember, I think, good briefly, hands and staring up.
That "we haven't taken and eaten" line itself in that poem, which constitutes that core, none of those words are original. They are all just found and reordered from Thomas Harriot's account of Virginia.
Sick. I have the names in the country language. We have seen and eaten. Fastened with a string, the fire until it is.
So you juxtaposed Genesis and then the narrative up against a kind of post-apocalyptic world that has hope and destruction.
One is dealing in a world where we have already taken and eaten and we've already essentially destroyed the planet. And then what does that look like to be an artist or human in that world? Which in some way I think we're trying to say we're maybe already there right now.
Another thing that maybe the three of us share as artists is the desire to make original work, to make really collaborative work, to make portable work that we can take to interesting places, but then also to have it be, I guess, in a small p kind of way, political. Now that it engages some difficult things.
It's kind of amazing to me how these stories, the story that women are responsible for all evil in the world and that women will be saved through childbearing. Wings of mourning, like a very small acorn. Wings of mourning, small fruit growing. And then the story that we find in Harriet, that the land was here for us to take, and the invisibility of indigenous people in that narrative. Those stories are still really with us in their rawest form.
The one thing we share, or me with Kevin and Abby, is we have a politics of non-identity and openness that doesn't have a totalizing, essentialistic drive to it. So the work has maybe more questions than answers, and that was a glue between the three of us where we'd rather be in a state of asking questions and exploring questions rather than posing answers.
Who could not easily understand?
What are some of the questions?
I think the question of what does it mean to be a person in a world that's on fire with this urgency, with, you know, the polar ice caps melting.
Frantic or extremely sick, we have seen and eaten the fire until it be.
You know, the fact that I like McDonald's, that drives me crazy, that I'll eat a burger and be like, wow, like this is completely destroying the planet and I'm eating burgers still. And so it's not like we're proposing some sort of vegan solution. It's like, and I'm a totally real person who likes donuts too. So, you know, and so it's like, what do we do? And this was at least an attempt of doing something creatively. To address, I guess, that kind of contradiction that we all are experiencing.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick. You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Kevin Sims, Scott Wostliger, and Abby Miner about their experimental percussion monodrama, We Have Taken and Eaten.
Tell us about some of the instruments.
One of the stations is a large bass drum and a glockenspiel. So that's maybe the more traditional station, that sort of traditional percussion instruments. And the other station has a drum, but the drum is actually just a little table for these Tibetan prayer bowls. And then there's a small handheld amplifier runs on a 9-volt battery that we then use contact mics with to amplify the temple bowls, sometimes to create feedback on the amplifier. So that's sort of this electronic thing that goes along with a lot of the other things. And then over at that drum temple bowl station, there's also the light bulb. It's plugged into that little amplifier, has a contact mic on it, and that makes it resonate.
You seem to be working with elements, too.
Yeah.
Fire?
Yeah.
We have seen and eaten the fire until it be.
Water?
Right.
Make the water go there or here.
Well, when Abby gave me the text, or after we'd worked on it, it was about maybe 15, 20 pages of poems that I've sifted through. And I think I intuitively or unconsciously was drawn towards the poems that had the elemental qualities.
They burn into ashes. Have I digressed? They run away into small pieces and stamped, and then being chased, they climb.
And I think that's something I share with Kevin too, this simple notion of let's just think elemental terms, like elements maybe being a relatable category that transcends certain cultural constructions on some level, like a fire is fire for everyone, water is water for everyone, and it emerged from the text. And not to mention the text deals with explorers taking land, and so in some way it was in the text to have elements. It was there for the taking.
Though there be fish in the sea, their bounds are so large, they so wild, and we so weak and ignorant, we cannot much trouble them.
I really was interested in the God the Gaps unmapping.
Unmapping.
So the after creepeth, quiet it down, unborn leaves. Heaven was, and quiet it down.
And you were talking a little bit, Scott, about how you didn't want the voice to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
Everything blends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I certainly heard it there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Could you talk about, as a composer, what you were trying to do to have this blending of environmental notions,
right,
meditative notions,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then the instrument and voice,
right,
becoming an elemental sense of the world?
When I was writing it, I had that little amp at my house, and I had the contact mics, and everything Kevin was doing, I did in my own way at home. And I think it was just actually quite a bit of experimenting to find what actually worked. It wasn't conceptual at all. It was very practical. What you're hearing in that movement is, that's just me trying to find a way for my own voice to interact with these objects. And a lot of it also depends on the way the amplifier is working. Kevin has to become sympathetic with the machine, as it were, to actually blend with it. So what you're hearing is listening on the performer's part, where he's being empathetic with the object. And I think that's a kind of listening that Kevin's uniquely good at, and that's why I like working with Kevin, because he has that kind of empathy with sound.
Right, and when you said empathy with, Kevin was very close to the light bulb.
That's right.
Almost,
mm-hmm,
singing into the light bulb.
Very much. Yeah, I think those two moments, the light bulb movement and the amplifier movement for me, are really tender. They're kind of making their own sound that I then am singing back to them, and it animates them. I know the experience, maybe of seeing it, but definitely for me performing it, it is almost like a little love scene in both cases. And it's a strange post-apocalyptic love scene, because it's a light bulb and a little amplifier that you're in conversation with. And also sometimes what the amp does is very tuneful, and then I reflect that tunefulness back to the amp or back to the light bulb.
Green, need, bang. Green, need, bang.
I really enjoy the tenderness of those two movements. And I think visually maybe you get that too, because I'm very intimately close to it.
This at last is, this at last is, husked like a chestnut, alien again.
Let's just talk about each of the major pieces you did. Mm-hmm. This at last is Wings of Morning like a very small acorn. And that was jarring. What was that noise, first of all, which kind of freaked me out?
Yeah. So that's just one of the temple bowls. Should I maybe play?
Sure.
So it's kind of like a pure sound, but what we do is then the contact mic is amplifying that. And there's all kinds of tiny little sounds that are in there that you don't get without the contact mic in it. Slash, there's just these little dissonances and feedback and distortions that happen. So, but that's all it is I'm just tapping the rhythm of the words on that. But with the contact mic on the bowl, it really goes nuts.
But it's odd because this is almost a meditative poem.
Yes. Well, I don't have a problem with the idea of jarring music or art. I mean, I think art should be beautiful, jarring. It should be a lot of things. Amplifying it also fit into the aesthetic of the piece, where it's like maybe temple bowls after the world's ended aren't so beautiful anymore. Maybe they are a little jarring, or maybe they are a little distorted. But I also think the distortion for me becomes actually quite beautiful because it is this complex tone that you're hearing. And jarring is okay aesthetically. If you want to hear something pretty, there's plenty of other pretty things one can seek out.
And I like you didn't make it pretty because it would have sounded too meditative.
But yeah, right, right.
The world is all torn up.
Right, right. Right. I think it actually does have a meditative quality, but it's an apocalyptic meditation.
We have taken and eaten.
Fruit with seed in it, whose seed is in itself. Something to walk on, a story crushed, letting off the scent of sun. Why God made the light 3 days before God made the sun, I don't know.
The fourth scene would be fruit with seed in it, whose seed is in itself. And here you have three tape recorders, mm-hmm. and they play against each other, and mm-hmm. you just let them play.
Basically, with just sort of me being the only performer going on tour for this, we wanted to come up with some different ideas of how that movement can go. And so for this one, there's a little bit of a score. It's just kind of a set of instructions of how to record three different parts. And so it just takes two sentences of the text and does this repetition, but with strict numbers of how many times you're repeating each word. And then they're sort of loosely coordinated, but they go along, and then these sort of rhythms develop between those words.
I think part of the idea was that you would start to hear the language dissociated from its linearity, and that you'd start to hear the relationships between the words and create new sentences and be in a cloud of language as opposed to having a clear meaning. And like Kevin said, it's a process piece, so it has actually a pretty strict set of rules. That's why it's also so monotonous.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Kevin Sims, Scott Wostlinger, and Abby Miner about their experimental percussive monodrama, We Have Taken and Eaten.
Though there be fish in the sea, their bounds are so large.
They so wild, and we so weak and ignorant.
We cannot much trouble them.
These are all words from John Smith, founder of the Jamestown colony. He has a very strange journal that he kept with some bizarre observations. And so that was another one of the source materials that Abby was lifting from. And this one, I think, is almost surprisingly unmessed with. It's quite intact, actually.
It was just John Smith straight up.
But just expressed as a poem.
So tell us about the way that you perform this.
So this is the light bulb piece. And so it imitates the low note, high note of the glockenspiel and bass drum. And this has that with the back and forth of the amplified light bulb and the temple bowl. And so they're kind of the low note and the high note now. But then I sing along with them. And maybe this has some of the more straight singing in it, too, where I'm almost just harmonizing with the light bulb. And then there are a couple moments where it's more intense and I sing into the light bulb, where the light bulb turns into a kind of amplification.
This movement has a transformation of the We Have Taken and Eaten refrain, reprise song that keeps coming back throughout the piece. What marks that music is this chromatic scale that's always happening, these three notes. Be-da-da. And so Fish in the Sea is those three notes, but now it's in tune with the light bulb, which I think is an E flat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So
you searched everywhere for this E flat.
I must give credit where credit is due. My wife tapped the light bulb and said, this sounds cool. And then I was like, but then it was also this, the image of a human playing with this little tiny light bulb. And like Kevin said, almost in this intimate, loving way, singing with it. And the image of that, when we were workshopping it, I said, what if you sang with this light bulb? And then we filmed it on my phone and watched it and said, that'd be really powerful to see that happen on stage.
There's some irony in that too. You know, he's liking the Chesapeake Bay, and we cannot much trouble them, which is clearly not the case because we have very much troubled them. You know what I mean? But then that's sort of right. Coming from John Smith's mouth. It's if you're really kind of seeing this landscape, the worldview that arrived here in the 1600s, how that then is alive now.
And I think one thing that emerged to me with this text was the notion that some things are wild and can't be captured or bound up.
Heaven was, and my love, hang on your pale. The God had an idea, how we knew blessed when we saw it. The God that maybe this is something that Gertrude Stein would have advocated or appreciated, I don't know. But I did a lot of different games while I was writing, but I spent an afternoon at one point writing down in order every seventh word from Genesis. I chose seven to just respect the meaning of the number seven to Genesis itself. It seemed appropriate. So I wrote down every seventh word from Genesis and then used little phrases that appeared in that chronological record of every seventh word. So things like heaven was, and.
And so Abby kind of calls up Gertrude Stein mm-hmm. in the last one.
Right.
Certainly when we have lines like heaven was, and.
Right.
And then heaven was, and make the water go there or here. And
the God the gaps unmapping, so the after creepeth, quiet it down, unborn leaves. Heaven was, and quiet it down.
The line, the gods the gaps unmapping, to me is a very beautiful phrase, the notion of like unmapping the earth. Like, what's that look like? Again, this idea of things not being able to be bound up at all, that things are expanding outward or things are free to be wild.
Make the water risk and roar.
With the make the water risk and roar moment, where I think of it as make the water do that, just like let it go out and be crazy. Again, this sense of unbound wildness, I feel, is under this text. And when he's hitting the bass drum saying, how no thing, how nothing, I almost imagine someone saying that out into the open night sky where there is this boundless, unknown universe. And it's a we're all going to die moment. How nothing? It's almost a question for me. How is there nothing?
Fourth one with a fruit with seed in it, it's I don't know, and then know it burningly,
right.
And then know
right.
as in nothing. So how is this about knowing?
Well, that's the question. Yeah.
Are you trying to do something with respect to know at the end?
I would say no, because I'd say once you know something, it's over, it's done. It becomes boring or it becomes dead once it's known. You know, maybe there's a deeper sense of knowing that we're trying to get, and maybe the know it burningly kind of touches on that, that if you really know something, it burns inside of you.
I just like how you're playing with know and N-O and K-N-O-W. And you're using emphatic phrases and sounds.
Yeah, I almost wonder, with the climax of it, I think experientially, it's by far the longest. It's twice as long as a lot of the movements are. And then I'm moving around, the most sound is happening, so that's not maybe necessarily a concrete point that's being made, but I think it really stands out in the arc of the piece, experientially, both playing it and witnessing it. It's one and only shape.
So how does the piece end?
Well, the reprises keep getting compressed every time they come back. And by the time it comes back, there's a refrain where Kevin says, cranes, swans, sea crabs, burns. And on the last reprise, every time Kevin repeats that chorus, one of the creatures is gone from the refrain. So the final thing, he just says, I'd say it ends quite nasty in a way, but I think it's okay. It throws itself away at the end. So the refrain in some way to come back after Note Burningly seems futile, and I think the futility is reflected in the way it's composed. We don't even need to be this negative anymore. We know something burningly now.
I can't end with all the species of the earth dying. There is hope.
I would say the possibility of hope is suggested in this piece. And I think we'd leave it at that, with the possibility of hope. And we'll leave it up to others to create a scenario where hope is possible.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to percussionist Kevin Sims, composer Scott Woeslinger, and poet Abby Miner for their experimental monodrama, We Have Taken and Eaten. Thanks to the incomparable sound genius of Mr. Chris Hickey, who helps us produce these shows. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's end this experiment with the words of John Smith. History is the memory of time, the life of the dead, and the happiness of the living.